Roman Halter, Roman Halter, Reel 16. When you were describing your time in the ghetto and the Jewish committee, it seemed that a lot of the sort of actions were very self-interested by this committee. Did you get any impression in the war that, you know, some Jewish people did cooperate a bit with the Nazis, the SS?
I think one has to understand what happened, that these people in a way were aware what happened in Warsaw. News trickled in that Warsaw was being liquidated. They were determined that they are going to play for time, try to survive. They had an inner group of friends whom they could trust. The Germans decided that they are going to squeeze the ghetto from close to 500,000 people to, but then there were 70,000. They demanded certain transport out of the ghetto. They imposed rations by giving only so little food. And the ration mainly was starvation. So the ones who were at the very top received better food. And that's only human. But I feel that all the wrongdoing was not of the people, Jewish people who were running the ghettos, of the Germans who imposed these things onto the ghetto. And I can only think of people who travel on trains, and there are not enough trains, and they pack everybody in this compartment, and people can't sit down, and there's not enough air, and they become irritable with one another. It's not their fault. It's just simply that there's a shortage of trains. And there was this terrible thing imposed on the people who were running the Lodz ghetto. And really, they had no option, because if they refused, they were killed. And if they did not do what was demanded of them, Lodz ghetto would have been liquidated. They thought, perhaps, if we stretch it out, if we do this, if we do that, some of us will survive, all of us are going to be murdered. And in a way, true, I'm here, who was a member of the Lodz ghetto, who was sent there, and quite a number of other people who survived, who were in Lodz ghetto. It is important to see the total picture, not to accuse Rumkowski or his other men who were running the Lodz ghetto, but to see it now in a totality the way it was. And the totality is that it was imposed from Hitler to Himmler to other SS and right up to the Lodz ghetto, and they played with Jewish people till they murdered them. They exploited them. They robbed them of everything they possessed. And it suited the German hierarchy to keep Leyer Lodz ghetto up to 44, middle of 44. And it was a place which gave out rich pickings, both in all the factories which produce things for the Wehrmacht, and also robbing every Jew who came to Lodz ghetto and within Lodz ghetto of all the valuables which they had. And Lodz was a very rich center for Jewish people. So I don't really hold it against Rumkowski and other people. Saying that, I don't think I would have had the stomach to obey and do what they have done. Because at one stage, it comes to a point, enough is enough. I would not string along with the demands imposed on me. But that's the individual sort of thing. And also, as I said before, it's very much easier said than done.
I remember you saying much earlier that perhaps the line should have been drawn about the children's deportation, the order given.
Yes, that was terrible when he spoke publicly and he said, I want you to give up your children because we have a quota demanded of us that so many children have to be sent out from Lodz ghetto. And please do this because Himmler, 43 in October, in his speech said, and when we deal with the Jews, we have to deal with the children first, because when they grow up, they will take revenge on us. So they are the first to go. And that was passed on to those Gestapo men, SS men, who were running the Lodz ghetto, and that was passed on to Rumkowski. And he stood there, and he had to make this announcement, because it was asked of him to do so. So he said, willingly, voluntarily, please give up your children. True enough, how can one do this? To us, this is not comprehensible, and also it's not comprehensible for someone who's running an orphanage before the war, which he was. But these times were abnormal. These times were so horrendous that one cannot rationalize with a healthy mind in circumstances that we live of how people behave, what they did.
When you came to Britain with the boys, do you think the Jewish community did enough for you? You know, how welcoming was the British Jewish community?
Leonard Montefiore, who was chairman of the Jewish Refugee Committee and later on became Jewish Relief, was a wonderful, humane man. He gave quite a lot of his money, and some people came in with some funds, but they were very short of money. They did everything they could with very little. And we, of course, did not understand it. We wanted to get an education, but of course they did all they could do. And they wanted to bring the maximum number of children. They requested the Foreign Office to give them permit, and they received a permit for 1,000. Only 732 came. And again, they did as much as any human being could do. One has to remember, 45 were austere years, or 45, 46, 47. And England spent all its wealth and energy on the war, and there was not so much then. One couldn't tap resources, because no resources were there to tap, and they managed to tap all the resources they could.
Were you given sort of hospitality by Jewish people when you came, particularly when you moved to London? You know, was there...
No, we couldn't understand that. The Jewish people who were here thought that because we went through such terrible experiences, we have been marked by them, that we will infect their children. In fact, we're kept away from them. We're in our hostels, and some people came to visit us, but very few people from the outer Jewish community invited or mixed with us, or asked us to mix with them. There was quite a misunderstanding about us, and you know, I now think now of a bird that is unfortunate being dipped into tar because there's oil spillage and comes out black, and they thought would be black for life. Some people didn't want to mix with us. It didn't worry us very much, really. We're so happy that the war ended. One had a tremendous life force, one wanted to live. There were beds, there was food, fresh air, seasons, and a tomorrow. And no fear, really. One didn't have to wake up and see whether there was somebody standing over you with a whip or a butt of a rifle.
You mentioned the boys who came over, and I believe you said there were some girls.
Yes.
One doesn't hear an awful lot about the girls.
No, because in the group, 732, there were about 80 girls only.
How did that work out? You know, were the boys and girls, were you all together, or did they take the girls off? elsewhere?
The girls had their own hostel, a girls' hostel. Quite a number of boys married some of the girls who came over. And we, later on, when this Primrose Club was formed, the girls used to come to the Primrose Club, and one knew them. But because one knew them from the time it came over, one looked upon them not as girlfriends so much as almost sisters, and one didn't find a great feeling of discovery about them. So many boys married outside the group of girls. Some of the girls married also people not within the group.
Do the girls keep to the reunions like the boys?
Yes, they do.
Yes.
In fact, they've been honored by being called the boys.
And they accept that, do they?
They laugh at it. It's really... Within Martin Gilbert's book, when he says the boys, he talks of the girls, but they're also one of the boys, and there are lots of little funny remarks being passed.
Could you tell me about the Primrose Club, what this was?
Well, eventually, when people became independent, they still had a need of meeting one another, because it became like an extended family. And so the committee conceived that they're going to have in Belsize Park a house where certain socials are going to be held. They will have dancing there, they will have a canteen, they will have people who play chess, table tennis, volleyball outside in the garden. They will get together in order to form a football team, basketball. And the man in charge was Yogi Maya. He was chosen because he was a sports leader in Germany before he came to England. And he was, on the whole, a well-meaning person, but I personally felt that he had limited horizons, and he had certain preconceived ideas of what we ought to do and not to do. There was a great compulsion, quite a number of us, to record our experiences then. And he discouraged that. He felt that the activities of every day are sufficient to occupy us. We should not go back and record it. These recording of experiences, whether in written word or just words, or telling other people's stories, or having it somehow written down, were important. And he did not see that. And he wanted to make us very English or very British. And he thought that that's the height of being acculturalized. He did quite a lot of good because he found I had swimming abilities. And he invited me to train the swimming session. Finchley Road, now with the Sainsbury, there was a swimming pool, and was very proud that I was a good swimmer, but I found that I wasn't quite on his wavelength, although I did not feel like having an argument in order to tell him, because he was in a higher position than I was, and as I was disadvantaged by one member of the committee, I didn't want to pick a quarrel with somebody else. Then he discovered that I had an artistic ability, and when he organized the badge for the Primrose Club, we had a competition. When I won this competition for the badge, he called me in his office and he said, "Now you are doing something important, Roman. My congratulations to you." So he's an extraordinary man, because he's well over 80 and he's still so active. He goes over to Germany now and lectures, because German is perfect, of course, having come from Germany. And his version of us, according to him, is much more truthful than our version of ourselves. And he knows about us so much more how he managed to rehabilitate us fully into generous, charitable, big-hearted human beings. Primrose Club was essential because people got together there, talked the English with the accent that we were taught by the people who were themselves refugees, and nobody laughed at us, and some of the boys became very good table tennis players, and one of them in particular who went to America became a sort of a state champion. Others became very good dancers. He even felt we should start playing cricket. There was a Primrose Cricket Club form, and ex-Holocaust members were wearing white flannels and batting and bowling. It's a good old yogi. He had his usefulness, but then any new experience was a welcome experience to us.
Yes. Did the 45 AIDS Society develop from the Primrose Club?
Yes, in a way it was a continuation of that. We didn't have a house for the 45 AIDS Society. It was conceived really by some of the members. 45 is because we came in 1945. 8 because we wanted to help those who are in need of help. And it was our society. So this went on, and eventually the driving force of it was Ben Helfgott. I was very preoccupied with my architectural studies, and so I was on the periphery of it. For a time I was on the committee, but then it appealed to some of the members to have meetings and be on committees. It was a new thing for them. And they were mainly preoccupied themselves with having a annual reunion. And this reunion was that everybody was togged out in black tails and paid so much money for dinner, and there was music, and somebody was invited to make a speech, and then Ben Helfgott spoke, and became an annual event. So really, the 45 AIDS Society first and foremost concerned itself with this, with the reunion. Then they also appointed some people who looked after the welfare in order to find out who has gone to hospital. And this man from the social committee used to go along and bring flowers and find out how the person is doing and report to the committee. And now it's quite a successful social committee. It's a charitable organization. Quite a lot of money which was raised by the member of the 45 AIDS Society has been given to other useworthy causes. We have our president, who is Sir Martin Gilbert now. And it's really doing very well. I am now on a committee which is an offshoot of the 45 Society, where we want to claim for Jewish slave labor compensation, because we feel appalled the SS, who are torturing, beating, and guarding us, receive a pension, and we have not received compensation for the slave labor. And most of us who survive because we're slave laborers. 90% perish. The average years of a slave laborer was about 3 months. We feel that it's only just and right that we should be compensated for it. So together with 3 other people, we are pressing for compensation. We've had a meeting with the German ambassador last December, December 1996, and we are waiting the outcome of our meeting. He apparently passed on the information which we gave to him, and we were there with him for about 90 minutes. He passed it on to Bonn, and we are waiting to hear from Bonn. Now, the members of the 45 Society are in need of funds, but they have tremendous pride. They don't want to feel that they are begging. I am quite convinced that everyone of them is entitled because they were deprived of education. They suffered through slave labor. The Jewish slave laborers received the worst jobs in the worst conditions and worked indirectly for German firms that are still in existence. The people who were paid for our slave laboring were the SS. We're constantly under their supervision, and we could be done away with impunity. So the 45-8 Society goes on in certain ways, and if there's something extraordinary, then a subcommittee is formed like this one. And that gives them a chance to have the reunions where members who left for Canada, America, Israel, other countries, come for this reunion. And they're made very welcome. And Ben Helfgott and the committee are carrying on. He has been now chairman for umpteen years, and he's still chairman. He's a very good catalyst because he hasn't got a bad thought in his head. And if he finds the meeting goes on a little bit too long, he puts his head on his hand and lets it freewheel. This discussion comes to an end, and then he says, "Now, right, we'll do this," in a democratic way.
The news one hears about Switzerland and the sort of Jewish money which it is thought the banks hold, are you concerned with that at all?
Well, we are, because we Jewish claimed slave labourer feel that this money should come to the survivors, comes to anyone. And we should be the ones who decide to what charities we want to apportion certain sums of money, if we do want to apportion. Some really badly do need the money themselves. And there are various individuals and various other committees that want to claim money for their causes. And they really should come at the very tail end of it. We are the ones who should benefit, if that's the word for it. So now, the latest news was that for 42 million was put into a kitty, and mostly the bulk will go to America, but some of it should go really to us, the survivors here, and the 45-8 Society members. I think altogether in England, whether there are 45-8 Society or outside the 45-8 Society, there are about something sort of 300, not more, in the UK.
Did you ever hear any more from Mrs. Fuchs, or did you ever see her again, the lady who helped you at the end of the war?
Well, I saw her last year. I went to her 88th birthday. And Steyer, who was also hidden by her, who survived, came from Israel with his daughter, and we celebrated her birthday. She's an exceptional person because she staked her life and her husband's life. Unfortunately, he was murdered. He was shot when the Russians already occupied the area 5 days after the liberation. when the assess in the village heard that Mr. and Mrs. Fuchs hid three Jews, they came along, took Mr. Fuchs out, took Schweitzer, the Jewish colleague, Steyer, who was also a Jewish colleague, and into a field and shot Schweitzer and Fuchs. And Steyer saved his life. He talked himself out in a certain way, and then eventually in Israel he told me how he did that and what happened. Well, anyway, he, Steyer, with his daughter, who is a lawyer, came from Israel for the celebration of Mrs. Fuchs' birthday, and I came from England. I came before they arrived, and Mrs. Fuchs is now frail, and her eyesight is not very good. It was lovely to see her, because she's a big-hearted, generous person. And I took her out for a meal, and I took her to this restaurant close to where she lives in Oberpoer, it's part of Dresden now, and asked for something nice and easy for an old lady to digest. So they brought her fish. First they brought fish soup, which was nice, she enjoyed that. Then nicely cooked fish with mashed potatoes, mashed broccoli, and she liked that. But it was a bit too much for her oldest. She doesn't eat such big helping. So when I took her back to her home, she wanted to have a little sleep, a little siesta. And at 4 o'clock, that was about something like, we went for an early lunch, that was about something like 2:30. At 4 o'clock, some of the men from the press were due to come. So she lay down on the settee and I put a rug over her and she fell asleep. At 4 o'clock, there was this ringing at the door and hammering on the door, and she woke up very slowly. I didn't want to go there to open because it's her home. And she went to the door, and she was positive that she slept through the night, and she said to them, "You were supposed to come yesterday. Why do you come this morning?" Poor thing. Anyway, they came. I felt that the interview was with her because she was the star. I simply added a little bit to it. And she has suffered so much for that deed that she had performed, because quite a lot of the Stasi, the secret police in East Germany, were former SS. And they took out a file that her husband was shot because he committed atrocity against the Russians. And so this file followed her, so to say, to such an extent that she didn't get a pension. She had to act as a washerwoman and get pieces of food or a little bit of money from the people in the village. But you can see that she was washing clothes because her forearm so developed the muscles from washing clothes by hand. And really, her house was taken away, given to some Stasi, and she was given very tiny rooms. Perhaps she has about the size of two of these spaces, which are, 8 feet by 2.5 meters by 3.5 meters, something like that, two spaces. Anyway, this celebration when Steyer came was wonderful, and he stayed, of course, in the best hotel in Dresden, which was the Hotel Kempinski. And